This is the third day of this July 2008 7-day session. We'll return to our text, which is the collected works of Chinul. Chinul being the 12th century Korean Zen master. We're reading from the chapter called Secrets on Cultivating the Mind. It's in a question and answer format. Question: what is this mind of void and calm, numinous awareness? Chinul: what has just asked me this question is precisely your mind of void and calm, numinous awareness. Why not trace back its radiance rather than search for it outside? For your benefit, I will now point straight to your original mind so that you can awaken to it. Clear your minds and listen to my words. From morning to evening, throughout the 12 periods of the day, during all your actions and activities, whether seeing, hearing, laughing, talking, whether angry or happy, whether doing good or evil, ultimately, who is it that is able to perform all these actions? Speak. If you say that it is the physical body which is acting, then at the moment when one's life comes to an end and the body has not yet decayed, how is it that the eyes cannot see, the ears cannot hear, the nose cannot smell, the tongue cannot talk, the body cannot move, the hands cannot grasp, and the feet cannot run? So he's talking about a corpse that is just right after death. It can't do any of these things, the body. You should know that what is capable of seeing, hearing, moving, and acting has to be your original mind. It is not your physical body. Furthermore, the four elements which make up the physical body are by nature void, empty. They are like images in a mirror or the moon's reflection in water. How can they be clear and constantly aware, always bright and never obscured, and, upon activation, be able to put into operation sublime functions as numerous as the sands of the Ganges? For this reason it is said, drawing water and carrying firewood are spiritual powers and sublime functions. This is a famous saying attributed to the great enlightened Layman Pong. That's how he's known in Zen texts. Layman Pong is one of the most legendary enlightened lay people. Most of the people who made it into the literature were monks and nuns. Here, this is a great statement of the Zen spirit. Rather than saying my spiritual powers and sublime functions are levitating or reading the minds of others or clairvoyance or any of this other nonsense, it's just, he just says, drawing water and carrying firewood are my spiritual powers and sublime functions. I could say, doing laundry and mowing the lawn are my spiritual powers and sublime functions. These simple activities, these simple daily activities, acquire this kind of majesty when the mind is free of thoughts. To do anything no-mindedly is to be in the presence of this true nature, this Buddha mind. Try it for yourself. Try washing your dish, your bowl after lunch, cup, with absolutely nothing in the mind, just the movement. Just. It becomes a ceremony, an act of reverence, a mystery, or just bowing. To bow, make a simple standing bow with nothing in the mind, is awe-inspiring. He goes on, this is the life force of all the Buddhas and patriarchs. Have no further doubts about that. Since it has no form or shape, how can it be large or small? Since it cannot be large or small, how can it have limitations? Since it has no limitations, it cannot have inside or outside. Since there is no inside or outside, there is no far or near. As there is no far or near, there is no here or there. As there is no here or there, there is no coming or going. As there is no coming or going, there is no birth or death. As there is no birth or death, there is no past or present. As there is no past or present, there is no delusion or awakening. As there is no delusion or awakening, there is no ordinary person or sage. As there is no ordinary person or sage, there is no purity or impurity. Since there is no impurity or purity, there is no right or wrong. Since there is no right or wrong, names and words do not apply to it. Since none of these concepts apply, all sense bases and sense objects, all deluded thoughts, even forms and shapes and names and words are all inapplicable. Hence, how can it be anything but originally void and calm and originally no thing? This mind, what he calls this mind of void and calm, numinous awareness, is something that everyone here can experience for herself or himself this week. We simply need to refrain from trafficking in thoughts, pursuing our thoughts, clinging to our thoughts and ideas and emotions and feelings, refrain from clinging to them, and in thorough absorption in the practice, we can find our way to the direct experience of this mind of void and calm, numinous awareness. Once we have glimpsed or experienced this mind, this no mind, even briefly, fleetingly, for seconds, even 1 second, we're never the same. We've seen that which is beyond all mental phenomena. not the same as awakening, but it's right there in the approach to it. He says, at that point where all dharmas are empty, in other words, where all things are seen as no thing, the numinous awareness is not obscured. It is not the same as insentience, for its nature is spiritually alive. This is your pure mind essence of void and calm numinous awareness. This pure, void, and calm mind is that mind of outstanding purity and brilliance of all the Buddhas of the three time periods, past, present, and future. It is that enlightened nature which is the original source of all sentient beings. One who awakens to it and safeguards that awakening will then abide in the unitary, unmoving liberation. One who is deluded and turns his back on it passes among the six worlds, wandering in samsara for vast numbers of kalpas. Although there is a distinction between delusion and awakening, in their basic source they are one. But as there is neither more, as it is said, the word dharma means the mind of the sentient being. But as there is neither more of this void and calm mind in the sage, nor less of it in the ordinary person, it is also said, in the wisdom of the sage it is no brighter, hidden in the mind of the ordinary person it is no darker. And then he says, since there is neither more of it in the sage nor less of it in the ordinary person, how are the Buddhas and patriarchs any different from other people? The only thing that makes them different is that they can protect their minds and thoughts, nothing more. Protect. It's an unusual word the translator chose here. The only thing that makes the enlightened different from ordinary people is they can protect their minds and thoughts, nothing more. Well, I have to differ with this. What makes the enlightened person different is having experienced the reality that enlightenment is the nature of all beings, and having the direct experience of that. The protecting, maybe he means that once enlightened, one is able and committed to living out of this no-minded, enlightened nature. One is more determined to refrain from letting the mind dwell in unnecessary things and dark realms. But that depends on the depth of the awakening. Question. Once the noumenon is awakened to, no further steps are involved. Why then do you speak of subsequent cultivation, gradual permeation, and gradual perfection? Again, for people who may be hearing this on tape for the first time, the noumenon is the translator's word for this realm of no mind that is beyond any any beyond phenomena of any kind. You could say the mind of this mind of emptiness, no thingness. Chinu, earlier the meaning of gradual cultivation subsequent to awakening was fully explained, but since your feeling of doubt persists, it seems that I will have to explain it again. And this, I'm going to go ahead and read this. It is something of a repetition, but I think it's valuable stuff. He says, for innumerable kalpas without beginning, up to the present time, ordinary people have passed among the five realms, coming and going between birth and death. So this is referring to the six realms. Oh, he says five. Normally he's talking about six, the six realms of unenlightened existence, the realms of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits and hellish realms, animals, deva realms, human realms, and the asuras, fighting demons. But these are all different worlds of unenlightened consciousness. So, since beginningless time, people have been ascending and descending this ladder of unenlightened existence. They obstinately cling to self, and over a long period of time, their natures have become thoroughly permeated by false thoughts, inverted views, ignorance, and the habit energies. We're all familiar with these things. The natures have become thoroughly soaked, steeped in false thoughts, ignorance, and habit energies. Although coming into this life, they might suddenly awaken to the fact that their self-nature is originally void and calm and no different from that of the Buddha's, these old habits are difficult to eliminate completely. Consequently, when they come into contact with either favorable or adverse objects, then anger and happiness, or propriety or impropriety, blaze forth. Their defilements are no different from before. If they do not increase their efforts and apply their power through the help of prajna, wisdom, how will they ever be able to counteract ignorance and reach the place of great rest and repose? As it is said, and then he quotes someone or other, although the person who has suddenly awakened is the same as the Buddha's, the habit energies which have built up over many lives are deep-rooted. The wind ceases, but the waves still surge. The noumenon manifests, but thoughts still invade. This is the sobering experience. Anyone who has had any degree of awakening can confirm through their own experience. The wind ceases, but the waves still surge. And then he quotes the great Chinese master Da Wei. Often, gifted people can break through this affair and achieve sudden awakening without expending a lot of energy, a lot of strength. Then they relax and do not try to counteract the habit energies and deluded thoughts. Finally, after the passage of many days and months, they simply wander on as before and are unable to avoid samsara. So, the importance, the absolute importance of ongoing practice after an initial breakthrough. Because these habit forces of reactivity and reaction, reacting to people and circumstances with anger or depression, hostility, with greed. These things are so deeply entrenched in the mind. That they need to be scoured on and on and on. Otherwise, that initial breakthrough becomes just a wonderful memory. He goes on, so how could you neglect subsequent cultivation simply because of one moment of awakening? After awakening, you must constantly be on your guard. If deluded thoughts suddenly appear, do not follow after them. Reduce them and reduce them again until you reach the unconditioned. Yeah, that's another word for the noumenon, or the realm of the absolute, of emptiness. Then and only then will your practice reach completion. This is the practice of herding the ox, which all wise teachers in the world have practiced after awakening. And then he concludes, hence, sudden awakening and gradual cultivation, that is, subsequent practice after awakening, are like the two wheels of a cart. Neither one can be missing. Some people do not realize that the nature of good and evil is void. They sit rigidly without moving and, like a rock crushing grass, repress both body and mind. To regard this as true practice of the mind is a great delusion. For this reason, it is said, Shravakas is the initial stage of awakening. Shravakas cut off delusion thought after thought, but the thought which does this cutting is a brigand. If they could see that killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and lying, these are the first four precepts, all arise from the self nature, then their arising would be the same as their non-arising. At their source, they are calm. Why must they be cut off? As it is said, do not fear the arising of thoughts. Only be concerned that your awareness of them not be tardy. So the point is that these thoughts and impulses themselves are not apart from our true nature. It's not like there's this big, vast realm of our true nature, but just on the outside, not making it into our true nature, is these transgressions, this misconduct. There's nothing outside our true nature, nothing at all. We don't indulge in these things, we don't break the precepts, because to do so causes harm. But they can't be said to be something outside our nature, our true nature. Same with the thoughts. Sooner or later, if the serious practitioner has to make peace with the arising of thoughts. It's what the brain does. It generates thought activity. That doesn't need to be a problem. It's only a problem when we pursue the thoughts. Do not fear the arising of thoughts. Only be concerned lest your awareness of them be tardy. So, what we don't want is to sit lost in our thoughts for any period of time. This then is just, that's not the real practice. That's just daydreaming. So the trick is to notice them right away when they come up. And then just return the mind to the practice. It's all about noticing. Noticing what the mind is doing at every moment, every split second. Yeah, I saw in another, periodical of another spiritual center, a Vipassana center, they had a little cartoon showing someone sitting in front of a TV, and on the TV screen it has this question: where is your mind? That is the question at every moment. Where is your attention? Notice it. If it's anywhere but on this practice that we're devoting ourselves to, just bring it back. No need to comment on or analyze it if it's somewhere else. And then he quotes someone else. It is also said, if we are aware of a thought at the moment it arises, then through that awareness it will vanish. In the case of a person who has had an awakening, although he still has adventitious defilements, means defilements that are not permanent, no defilements are intrinsic to our nature. Although he still has defilements, let's just say that, all defilements are adventitious, these have all been purified into cream. If he merely reflects on the fact that confusion is without basis, then all the flowers in the sky of this triple world are like smoke swirling in the wind, and the six phantom sense objects are like ice melting in hot water. In other words, all phenomena are without substance, ultimately. So the six phantom sense objects are sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, feelings, and thoughts are all like ice melting in hot water. They have no roots to them. If thought moment after thought moment he continues to train in this manner, does not neglect to maintain his training, and keeps samadhi and prajna equally balanced, then lust and hatred will naturally fade away, and compassion and wisdom will naturally increase in brightness. Unwholesome actions will naturally cease, and meritorious practices will naturally multiply. When defilements are exhausted, birth and death cease. When the subtle streams of defilement are forever cut off, the great wisdom of complete enlightenment exists brilliantly of itself. So it's a challenging task, freeing ourselves of these stubborn habit energies, but it's not a hopeless one. With long enough with commitment to practice and long enough involvement in it, he says, we can get beyond these things. Just a word about this word lust. Then lust and hatred will naturally fade away. Some people, I've come to learn, some people, when they hear this, lust fading away, get kind of nervous. They don't want their lust to fade away. But just consider this. He doesn't say the ability to respond sexually fades away. He's really talking about just sexual fantasies, basically, that can be such a burden, really. Being driven by one's sexual impulses. It's what he's talking about is a state of freedom where one is not driven by them. One is in the driver's seat, able to discern when it is appropriate, when it is suitable. For example, in marriage or a committed relationship, when it is appropriate to respond sexually. I remember one of the things I heard when I came to that stuck with me so much when I came to my initial workshop, introductory workshop in 1970, was when Roshi Kaplow said that our sexual cravings will wither. I still remember that word, wither. And at the time, I felt quite enslaved by my sexual cravings, and that was such a hopeful thing to hear, that this can, you can get on top of this. You don't have to get rid of it. You just have to get some freedom from it. You're not driven by it. I'm skipping a couple, three pages. And then he goes on, even though you are not yet able to accept this teaching, if it passes through your ears just once and you feel affinity with it for even a moment, the merit will be incalculable. Consider that. Even if you don't accept this teaching, the Dharma, if it passes, if you just hear it once and you feel an affinity with it, even for a moment, the merit will be incalculable. Do we believe this? It's really a remarkable statement. Do we believe it? Do we disbelieve it? And then he quotes some text called Secrets on Mind Only. Hearing the Dharma but not believing is still cause for the fruition of the seed of Buddhahood. Training on the Buddhist path, but not completing it, is still merit surpassing that of humans and gods. And then he himself says, but he who does not lose the right cause for the attainment of Buddhahood, and who, moreover, listens and believes, trains and completes his training, and guards his attainment without forgetting it, how can his merit be calculated? And then he goes on, if we consider our actions in our past wanderings in samsara, we have no way of knowing for how many thousands of kalpas we have fallen into the darkness or entered the interminable hell and endured all kinds of suffering. Nor can we know how many times we have aspired to the path to Buddhahood, but because we did not meet with wise teachers, we remained submerged in the sea of birth and death for long kalpas, dark and unenlightened, performing all sorts of evil actions. Though we may reflect on this once in a while, we cannot really imagine the duration of our misery. How can we relax and suffer again the same calamities as before? Furthermore, what allowed us to be born this time as human beings who are... What allowed us to be born this time as human beings who are clear about the right road of practice? Truly, a human birth is as difficult to ensure as a blind turtle putting its head through a hole in a piece of wood floating on the ocean, or a mustard seed falling onto the point of a needle. How can we possibly express how fortunate we are? This analogy, a blind turtle putting its head through a hole in a piece of wood floating on the ocean. This would be a sea turtle that just comes up once a year, I think they say, or something like that. And just right where it breaks, or its head breaks out of the water, it just happens to be a hole in a piece of wood floating there in the middle of the ocean. The chances of our encountering the Dharma are that rare, according to an old text. Or a mustard seed falling onto the point of a needle. So how are we using now? How are we using this time of practice? In particular, how are we using the sesshin? Doesn't hurt from time to time to just reflect on this, to reflect on the fact that the hours are passing. We're still in the first half of sesshin, but time is passing. You know, when you look at the membership rolls of the Zen Center, it is only a minority, a distinct minority of people who ever come to sesshin. Why that is, I don't know. Maybe many of the people who never come feel it's too much for them. But there are also people who never come who feel that they can't because of the circumstances of their lives. Family responsibilities, work responsibilities. Even most people here, other than staff, most people cannot get to many sesshins. It doesn't hurt from time to time to reflect on this and to even ask oneself, am I using this incredible opportunity as best I can? How am I using my mind, my attention, from moment to moment? There's always a danger in Sesshin, that we allow ourselves to settle into just a kind of state of peace and quiet. This is a real danger because it's settling for something that is so much less than is possible. Zen Master Hakuin refers to the honey sweet sensation of peace and quiet, and what a danger that is, how seductive it is, especially these days when just about everyone who comes to Sesshin, I would bet anything, just about everyone leads extremely busy lives, stressful lives, lives of turmoil and rushing about here and there, commuting and errands and meetings and deadlines. Never enough time. This is what I hear from so many of my students. Never enough time. Always hard to find time to sit. Well, we've got time now. This is it. What an opportunity. How might, each one of us might ask, how might we be sure that we're not sinking into this dead sitting, as Hakuin called it, dead sitting? Well, one of the great tools, one of the great offerings of Sesshin is the stick, receiving the stick. This is, many Zen centers have stopped using the stick, but I feel convinced that this is one of the ways to help prevent. It's no guarantee, but it's one way that will make it less likely that people in Sesshin are sinking into dead sitting. And will more likely keep the Sesshin energized, lively. As everyone surely knows, these two points where we're struck on the shoulders are along an acupuncture meridian that elicits energy. It's not just a matter of keeping us awake when we're drowsy, of having it wake us up, but it's a matter of how it can break apart any kind of vice of thoughts. We get into a train of thoughts, a cycle of thoughts that can make us feel in the grip of something that we just can't get out of. We feel trapped sometimes in these cycles of thoughts, stubborn thoughts, and we go around and around and around. Well, the stick is one way to break that apart, to free us from the tyranny of our thoughts. Gives us a little more energy, a little more focus. Otherwise, we risk just becoming a relaxation practice. How soothing, how wonderful to get away from work and home and just have all this silence and relax. There's nothing wrong with relaxation, but it's such a paltry benefit compared to awakening, having this experience of awakening to our true nature, this ultimate experience that a human being can have. No one here has the right to count themselves out of this. This is not out of the reach of anyone here. This is not just making people feel better. This is the truth. It is our nature, what we all have in common, and this is enlightened nature. How could we not be able to awaken to it? It's our nature, this enlightened mind, our essential mind. Why settle for less? But the forces of habit, the forces of the siren calls of ease and relaxation and the avoidance of discomfort can be powerful forces. When all is said and done, pain can be a great ally, whether it's pain in the legs and back or hips or ankles or whatever, that kind of ordinary physical pain, or the just intermittent brief pain of being struck by the stick. Pain concentrates the mind. Pain concentrates the mind. This is why it's can be a terrific ally, great asset in our practice, when we know how to use it, when we're not afraid of it. Most people in the beginning of practice are afraid to one degree or another, afraid of the stick or afraid of pain of sitting. But we can overcome this through our ability to be absorbed in the practice. We transcend it. We don't have to get rid of it. Who doesn't have pain in sesshin? You can have it, but it doesn't have to be a problem that holds you back. On the contrary, it can be a great spur to find a way beyond thoughts. I know that there are people who, for one reason or another, feel that they can't receive the stick as a medical reasons or who knows, some trauma from their past. But for those who don't have these real serious problems, before dispensing with a stick, before asking that it not be used, that'll never be questioned. If you don't want it, the stick, fine. That's not going to be questioned. But before you go to that, consider whether you need to, really, or whether it might just be an avoidance of a little momentary pain or pressure. If you don't want pressure, then these sesshins are not for you. You can go to a beach, you know, just lay down that towel and lather yourself up with sunscreen and just lie on the beach. If that's what you want, is just pure wonderful relaxation. So the point, whether talking about receiving a stick or going to a chair, is just to really be honest with oneself. And then, if you feel you need to do these things, by all means, do them. Do them and don't look back. Just do them. But just be sure that it's for a good reason. Sitting in a chair is a difficult way to concentrate. That's the only reason we sit on mats in these postures, because it makes it easier to concentrate, easier to get deep into one's practice, provided it's not too painful. When it gets too painful, so extremely painful that it's just, you can't get beyond the pain, then it makes sense to go to a chair or whatever it takes to relieve some of that pain. But it may not be as difficult as you think to get beyond the pain in the posture you're using. All right, our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.